Welcome to The Contrarians, where we are right and you are wrong. I'm Julio.
And I'm Alex. Here on the show, we rage against the Rotten Tomatoes machine. For the first half of each episode, Contrarians Corner, we trash the fresh red tomatoes and praise the rotten green splotches, making our case any way we can.
The aptly titled Real Talk serves as the second half of each episode. This is where we discuss our true feelings on the movie we're covering. For more information on our podcast and to browse past episodes, you can head over to our website, wearethecontrarians.com.
From there, you can also access our Patreon and merchandise, because capitalism.
If you enjoy our attempts at comedic film discussions, we encourage you to subscribe and leave us a review on whatever podcatcher you use.
If you'd like to reach out to us directly, that's what social media is for. You can find us on most platforms as @ContrarianPrime.
You can also see what we look like if you go to youtube.com/@ContrarianPrime, and you can contact us by email at wearethecontrarians@gmail.com.
I think that covers it.
Then it's time for the podcast. And we are recording for Contrarians Corner for Kill Bill Volume 2, but most importantly, for episode 200 of the Contrarians podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Contrarians, where we're right and you're wrong. My name is Alex. I am joined, as always, for the 200th episode, 200 times in a row, joined by my friend and co-host, Julio Oliveira. We are celebrating 200 in style with a guest that we'll get to in just a moment. And part two of our Kill Bill coverage, I guess, volume two, as it were. But on the main feed, you know, UFC is about to have UFC 300, their 300th numeric event. And, you know, we're giving them a run for their money. You know, they might have been bought for $4 billion, Julio, but, you know, we're priceless in what we offer here as we hit the milestone of episode 200. How many actual episodes do you reckon we have, though? Like, do you think we're close to
300?
300? Yeah. But
it is. I think I've tried to explain our numbering to people in different occasions. And as I go on, I'm like, this sounds ridiculous. There really is. I mean, so we're commemorating it because it's there. And really, I don't know about you, Alex. The main reason I like the numbers on the episodes is because it's a lot easier to point people to a number. You know, I don't have to tell them, hey, search for whatever title of the movie. And, you know, I can just say,
those are the ones
where
we actually, those are our bread and butter. That's where we do our gimmick. The other ones are just like us just fucking ad-libbing and bullshitting and whatnot.
Well, I think that as years have gone by, the bonus episodes, which used to be a little more free-flowing, have just basically become an extra main feed episode, which is fine with me. You know, for a while it was like, oh, the bonus are the ones that the patrons pick. And then now we flipped it to where, like, the bonus are usually the ones that we pick, except sometimes they're not, because sometimes we pick them all in a month, like this month. So really, there is no rhyme or reason. But whatever the case, when you look at your feed, it says 200 right now. So that, I think, should be celebrated, you know?
I agree. And we're celebrating it by concluding the epic adventure of one Beatrix Kiddo, as we learn, Black Mamba, the bride, Uma Thurman, in Kill Bill Volume 2. And he was along with us for Volume 1, so it was only fitting we brought him along for Volume 2. Julio, who's riding along with us?
Quentin Tarantino's Australian nemesis, Chaz Fisher from Drive Zero, is back to finish what we started. How are you doing, Chaz?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much, guys. It's a real honor to be part of episode 200. And as someone who also hosts a podcast that started many years before you guys started, and I'm only up to episode 100, the fact that you guys are clocking in at like bonus episodes 300 is frankly a little frustrating, demeaning.
Like, okay, well,
how dare you? Just throwing it in
fair,
my face.
Anybody who has listened to Draft Zero knows that the amount of work, the amount of homework that you have to do before you record that is a lot more than us just watching a movie and scribbling funny notes and then teasing each other for 2 hours.
Way to get people excited about my podcast there, Julio. Really selling it.
Writers like homework. They think that because it's procrastination. So it's like, oh yeah, I'll listen to Draft Zero if it means I don't have to work on my new draft. So, no, everybody listen to Draft Zero. More to come when we actually let Chaz plug it.
Now, to let listeners in behind the scenes, it's actually been about a month since we recorded the Kill Bill Volume 1. And I'm interested, I know when Julio watched Volume 2, but I'm interested, I'd watched Volume 1 with my wife and she enjoyed watching Volume 1 so much that we watched Volume 2 almost the next day. But Alex,
that's been the real cliffhanger.
You
sent us a message. It was like, I'm sorry, couldn't help it. My wife wanted to watch it now, so don't look at my letterbox. It's like, oh my God, what happened?
So Alex, when did you see Volume 2?
Yeah, I watched this earlier today. This morning I started it, and I started probably about 11 a.m. local time, and it wrapped up about 20 minutes ago before we stopped recording, or started recording, excuse me. It's on Peacock here in the States. So is that where you watched it, Julio?
Oh, yeah. 180 seconds of commercials, and then you just straight shot to Bill. No interruptions.
All right. Well, OQT back at the helm. We left off with the bride as she vowed to kill Bill. And a new cast of characters joins us this time. Some people we were introduced to in Volume 1, but really shine a bit more here. Specifically, David Carradine, Daryl Hannah, and the one and only Michael Madsen. Now, this movie was released on April 16th of 2004. Tarantino originally saw this as like a four-hour epic, and basically the compromise with Miramax was it's going to be split into two movies that'll be released, you know, a staggered format, so to speak. So 2004, Tarantino's Kill Bill journey culminated. October 10th of 2003 was Volume 1, and as I mentioned, April 16th of 2004 was Volume 2. Now, Julio, you had memories of the release of Volume 1 you discussed in our Part 1, or episode 199, I should say. Do you remember this following up so quickly? Do you remember the hype rolling into it?
I do, because I mean, I think anybody that was excited watching Kill Bill 1, you know, that's the cliffhanger. You want to see what happens. You want to see her? Honestly, okay, bottom line, I wanted to see her fight Michael Madsen. I caught like a close of a Michael Madsen at the end of Kill Bill 1, and the promise that, because you know that he's not going
to... Man, you got screwed.
I did. And I'm sure
this
that was
a prelude to Contrarian's Corner, right?
Yeah. But tell me that you were not interested in how that was going to play out. Because Michael Madsen may be a great actor, but he doesn't say Kung Fu Fighter. And So we saw her fight Lucy Liu, and we saw her fight Vivica Fox. And those were pretty acrobatic. So I was curious. I mean, what's going to happen when she gets to Bud? We'll get into that, but that question had an answer, and it was, well, it was what it was. But yeah, I went to see it probably opening weekend, and unlike Kill Bill 1, I did not rush to buy the DVD when it came out.
Chaz, did you see this in the theater?
I assume so, but unlike Volume 1, I don't have a firm memory of rushing to theaters to see it, but I'm pretty sure I would have, because I, you know, was young and childless and went to see all things in theaters back then. But I think, you know, because as we discussed in the last episode, I was not like blown away by Volume 1. I think I don't remember rushing to cinemas for Volume 2. What I do remember is the, you know, like the retrospective trying to fake that this was deliberately two films all along. And I remember a quote from the marketing materials along the lines of Quentin saying, Volume 1 is my Eastern and Volume 2 is my Western, which feels like horseshit when there is an extended martial arts training homage, you know, deliberately referencing like so many Eastern cinema traditions.
Alex, how about you? You didn't even watch Kill Bill 1 in theaters.
No.
So, did you even watch Kill Bill 2 before now?
I thought I had, but then I was watching it. I was like, no, I hadn't. Because I
hadn't even seen it.
No.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I thought I had, because the ending, the touch of death, was kind of famous in like circles of friends I had in college, like, you know, film friends, like, oh, you have to see this, you know. And then the opening monologue I definitely had seen before, so I started it and I was like, I've seen this before. And I thought coming into this project I had seen it also, But then quickly I was like, nope, I haven't seen this. Specifically the amount of Michael Madsen. I was like, I would remember this. I would remember that hat. I would remember that hair. So
those racial slurs that would really be branded in your memory.
It's a Tarantino movie for crying out loud. So
I'm a bouncer in a titty bar, Bill. If she wants to fight with me, all she's got to do is come down to the club and start some shit and we'll be in a fight.
Who knows how Chaz, myself, and Julio feel about this, but I can tell you who did like it, and that's 84% of the critics that comprise the Tomato Meter score. An audience score of 89%, so got that going for it. Julio, which quotes did you pull for us today?
All right, fresh tomatoes from the Rotten Tomatoes website. I'm going to start with Christy LeMire from the Associated Press, who says, if Kill Bill Volume 1 was like a roundhouse kick to the head, Volume 2 is practically a warm hug.
All right. Wow.
When?
Okay.
Which part specifically is the hug? The her being buried alive? Somebody getting her eye plucked out? What is it? David Anson from Newsweek says, Volume 2 fills in the motivational and emotional blanks that left the first movie tasting like a meal made only of appetizers. Now, those of you who listened to our part one episode, and you should have, because, you know, do it in order, you remember that both in Concerns Corner and Real Talk, we discussed the lack of substance. So maybe Tarantino like overdid it, adding the substance in this one. One or two monologues too many in Kill Bill Volume 2. What do you guys think?
There's a lot more talking. I wouldn't say there's more substance.
I would agree with that and just say it feels like he forgot a lot of exposition and things he wanted to do after making the first one. And it was like, fuck, I have to get this all crammed into part two.
All right, we're going to close with Maddie Lucas from The Dispatch, Lexington, North Carolina, who says, to watch a Tarantino film is to surrender wholeheartedly to his giddy genius, and this, his magnum opus, is no exception.
Dog, this was his fifth movie.
Or second half of his fourth one.
4.5. The nerve of saying that when he already had Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown out is quite absurd.
I think you mentioned it, one of you did, last episode, how there is a contingent of Tarantino fans that have Kill Bill at the top of the list.
And they're very loud about it.
Yes, and they're very passionate. And I think that maybe this guy's one of them. And he thinks that he peaked with Kill Bill.
I must have successfully muted them on my my feeds.
They're coming for you after this episode, Chaz. All right, Alex, those are the quotes. So I think we're ready for you to take us to Contrarian's Corner.
You've got to get over being mad at me and start becoming afraid of me because she is coming and she's coming to kill you.
I already mentioned the release date, budget of $30 million, which I believe was pretty comparable to that of Volume 1. And then Volume 1. Grossed a little bit more. That was $180 million, this being $150 million. All the key elements are the same, cast wise written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, music by RZA, Miramax film. So nothing really new we're going to go over there. But the pregnant bride and her groom rehearse their wedding. Bill, the bride's former lover, the father of her child, and the leader of the Deadly Viper assassination squad, arrives unexpectedly and orders the Deadly Vipers to kill everyone at the wedding rehearsal. Bill shoots the bride in the head, but she survives and swears revenge. So we got a bit of insight into this in Volume 1. We know the wedding massacre had happened, and now we kind of see some of the dialogue that came with it.
Only the dialogue.
Yeah, we get a recap. It starts with her driving in black and white. That's probably one of the more iconic just visuals of this is the black and white shot of her driving and saying she's going to kill Bill. She does the deal. She says the thing. And then
she breaks the fourth wall. Like, that's how Tarantino opens the movie. Chaz said that in Kill Bill Volume 1, Tarantino had started going up his own ass. And I think that Volume 2 is shot from inside his ass. Like, he's made it all the way in.
This is his colonoscopy.
Yes. Yeah. It opens with the main character recapping the previous movie as she addresses us directly in black and white, and then she drops the titular line. And Tarantino's like, and we're just getting started. Man.
And also, I mean, it's not just that it's black and white. Like, the black and white opening of Volume 1 was like, I'm trying to be like Ingmar Bergman or something like that. You know, it's trying to be classy. Whereas this is deliberately like echoing back to almost 30s or 40s film noir, like deliberately has the very obvious projection behind her. And look, sorry to skip out of chronological order, but did either of you guys just sit watching her pretend to steer the car against the shifting projection at the end of the movie?
Yes. It's a shame that she didn't have the big sunglasses and the scarf wrapped around her head, just to complete the look.
But again, you know, like the animated sequence from Volume 1, just a completely random stylistic departure that just seems to be because Quentin wanted it and does absolutely nothing for the film whatsoever.
It doesn't. But Alex, you like practical effects. So did you at least get that? Like, did you get a jolt of excitement when you saw that, you know, it was like the...
Oh, like Psycho or something? Yeah, like, I do like practical effects, and like, Tarantino's used this elsewhere, and other people have used it elsewhere in a way that kind of works better for me. Like, Chaz called it out, and it's something that I'm going to be saying a lot, both in Contrarian's Corner and very likely in Real Talk, is that it's just so transparent. Like, and it's, hey man, if someone gave me $30 million to make exactly, that's what we always joke about. Like, that's the dream. Rob Zombie, that's the dream. You get a studio to give you tens of millions of dollars to make exactly what you want to make with your friends. Like, that should be the dream as a filmmaker. But for me as a viewer, like, just like, all right, I get it. And because I came into this having watched Volume 1 already and in such close proximity, I was just like, all right, I know what's going. Let's keep it moving here. And the black and white aesthetic stays with the whole wedding sequence, which, again, I'm not sure what that adds. You know, we're literally just days removed from a film that was half black and white and half color winning Best Picture. And some people that don't understand subtext were very confused as to why half of that movie was black and white. But here it just seems like an artistic choice that Quentin just, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if he smokes. So let's just say, like, you know, the fourth pot of coffee on. And he's like, I got it. It'll be black and white. And then, you know, he goes to bed. Like, that was his big breakthrough about this opening sequence.
You're right that there is no rhyme or reason to it, because it's not even that it's just something as, you know, you could say that it's very pedestrian to just go like, well, black and white is the past and color is the present or whatever.
But no, they break that real quick. When she's getting buried alive, it becomes black and white again.
Right. And then when she... I mean, the movie keeps jumping back and forth between past and present. So it's like, you know, the Pai Mei sequences are not black and white.
They've got a filter on it to make it look like an old 70s kung fu movie.
Yeah, I guess they do. But when she finds out that she's pregnant, I mean, that's not black and white.
Touché. You know?
So there is really nothing other than, oh, well, the opening of Kill Bill Volume 1 was in black and white, so I'm kind of like stuck with having to show this sequence in black and white.
Maybe. And honestly, it seems like somewhere very early into making this, Quentin, and again, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, QT, but like, to me, what this feels like is that his like original thing that he saw in this was the bride getting shot in the head, and he saw it in black and white, and then he had to kind of like Legos things together around it and make pieces fit. And so that's why I feel like the black and white sequences,
black and white Legos.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I would think the black and white sequences make sense in his head more than they do to the audience. That's where I would kind of end that.
Well, here's an alternate theory, though, too, that it would also move us forward into like the actual meat of the sequence. That is that this is how we meet Bill. Like, finally, this is his introduction, right? Like, he spent 2 hours teasing us in Volume 1, and this is when we finally see him. And what if he just realized that David Carradine in color is not that impressive? It was like, the only way that we can have this sort of mythical introduction of this character that we've been building up for 120 minutes, man, it has to be black and white. Otherwise, he just looks like an old man. which he does later in the movie. So maybe that's really the crux of that sequence being black and white, is that if you put it in color, man, you're wondering why she doesn't kick his ass right there. She could have just taken Bill hostage, snapped his neck or something, and then, you know, now we have a real fight. Well, how do you guys feel about Bill? Were you as underwhelmed as I was?
Hell of a voice.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, look, I think he does menacing super well. And look, I'm not here to judge May-December romances.
like January-December.
Oh, yeah. But I think he's trying his best to be both menacing and charming, and I think he pulls both off. But I don't know. I just constantly struggled to think that, you know, they even call it out that, you know, her actual groom-to-be thinks he's her father, or then they, like, palm him off as an uncle, and you can see, like, the pain in his face as he gets, like, branded that way. So, you know, not to take away from Carradine, I think he's pulling in a hell of a performance. I just do wonder if he was slightly too old for this role by this point.
Alex, I'm curious about your take, because you sometimes are more forgiving when it comes to love stories than I am. I am harsher than Chess. I think that he puts on a good performance. I just don't buy the love story. I'll take that back. I buy it on her side, which is, you know, maybe that's why she should have gotten the Oscar, at least a nomination on this in this volume. Because the way she looks at Bill, I understand, like, I buy that she is smitten, that she has true affection. I just don't understand why. And I think that in order for me to understand why, this, I need to be feeling the same, like, on the other side. Like, I need to buy from the Carradine performance or the Carradine presence. And I just think, you know, that he is too old, and that might really get in the way of me buying them as a couple. Because if you buy them as a couple, I think that this movie works a lot better. But because I don't, then I'm just like, man, really? You couldn't do better than this dude?
Famous purveyor of romance and love stories, Quentin Tarantino. you guys know I wasn't crazy about Volume 1, so I kind of went into this with my arms folded to begin with. And then aside from her saying the baby was his, do they go in at much length that they were like a romantic item in Volume 1, or is that all kind of put on the table here?
I don't think they go into it at length, but, you know, like that opening monologue saying that it's him at his most masochistic, I think.
Yeah, he sounds like a spurned lover in that opening monologue. So you're right.
Yeah. And obviously, like you've said, it's his baby. So I think a lot is just read into it.
How did you find me?
I'm the man.
Julio, you mentioned here in the opening, we get a great cameo. I'll let you roll it out for the people. Because it caught me off guard. I wasn't aware of this.
I had forgotten that he was here. One Nicholas Fury shows up to tease us about maybe playing the piano. Man, give us that rehearsal. Give me at least like 30 seconds of Sam Jackson just playing a little tune. It's great to see Sam Jackson anytime. It's particularly rewarding to see him in a Quentin Tarantino movie. But then this movie doesn't do anything. Like, it's literally a cameo. You can't even say that it's just the curse of him being Sam Jackson now, because even back when Volume 2 came out, he was already Sam Jackson. Like, you saw him and you'd be like, oh, well, he was a bad guy in Jackie Brown. He was Julius in Pulp Fiction. So why do you put him there? It feels like a thankless role. You could have given it any of the other bigger parts in this movie, right?
I mean, all due respect to Michael Madsen, he would have made a much more interesting Bud. Obviously, couldn't have been Bill's brother, but I mean, you know, maybe adopted brother.
Yeah. If I'm going to buy that that the bride fell in love with Bill, I'm going to buy that Sam Jackson and him are related. I don't care. I'll make up this story in my mind.
There is a really dope tracking shot that backs out of the chapel here and before the, you know, the massacre. It's easily the most entertaining thing that happens here in the opening sequence, and then we get color. We're 15 minutes into the movie, and so we're brought into the 21st century here.
Now, we said that in Volume 1 there was a distinct lack of any decent dialogue. We were making that observation. We now have two extended scenes of the rehearsal itself, which is, you know, Sam Jackson is sitting in that room, and we have the two least interesting characters talking at length, which is the
the reverend
pastor, clergyman, yeah, reverend, yeah, and his wife. And then subsequently, the slightly more interesting conversation between Bill and Beatrix. But has the dialogue improved since volume one?
Well,
it depends on what you're looking for.
Quantity or quality? what's the metric here?
People talk a lot.
Yeah, there are some moments. Man, I am glad that I have rewatched his other movies as often as I have. Otherwise, the Kill Bills would make me second guess how much I appreciate the dialogue in those. I would be like, man, maybe they're not as good as I remember. But no, I mean, I've seen Pulp Fiction so many times. I've seen Jackie Brown so many times and Glorious Bastards. So I know that he had it before Kill Bill, and then he recovered it somehow after Kill Bill. But there is just something about the conversations in Kill Bill that isn't quite right. Like, his dialogue has always been artificial, but that's part of the charm of it, right? Like, he doesn't care about writing how people talk. He just cares about writing fun dialogue. But man, when like Bill and the bride are just trading, like going back and forth, and I guess it's supposed to be kind of, you know, rom-com-y, but also kind of threatening. There is just something that's not working. And it's not the delivery necessarily. I think it's the actual dialogue. And it keeps going because, you know, when Bill meets Bud.
Yes, it does.
There's just like the way that the characters repeat each other's sentences or fragments of their sentences. It just doesn't work for me. I don't know. How did you guys feel listening to these people talk about the movie a lot? That's another thing. I think that maybe one of the problems is that they don't have interesting conversations. Like, a lot of the conversations in this movie have to do with like things that happened in the previous movie or things that are going to happen in this movie. It's just, tell me something interesting. Like, the best that Bill can do, like way late in the movie, is come up with some TED talk about Superman that was like pretty tired even by then. So
we're definitely going to get to that monologue. But yeah. I mean, did anyone else just completely bump on Bud as a character? Because I know, like, we were joking in the previous episode about how these assassins were all like truly terrible at their jobs and like all retired early and broke apart, you know, for the 4 years after the wedding. I really felt like Bud, it makes no sense to me. He is a fucking super assassin. And I can understand a super assassin like falling on hard times, but working as a bouncer in a strip joint where that guy is just like crossing off his shifts, I'm like, Bud, you would kill someone for $200. There's plenty of people around you who want people dead. Just go and fucking kill people and you'll make more money than being a bouncer at this strip joint and
kill
cleaning
that
toilets.
Guy. Kill your boss.
Yeah. Take all his money. Like, I'm like, how? How is this guy? I mean, it just reinforced to me that maybe like Bill was in this delusional space that no one actually ever hired the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad. And he was just like in this cosplay of giving them snake names and they were just so fucking terrible.
4 years later, the bride, having already assassinated Deadly Viper Zoran Ishii and Vernita Green, goes to the trailer of Bill's brother, Bud, another Deadly Viper, planning to ambush him. Having been warned by Bill beforehand, he incapacitates her with a non-lethal shotgun blast of rock salt and sedates her. He calls Ellie Driver, another former Deadly Viper, and arranges to sell her the bride's unique sword for $1 million. He seals the bride inside a coffin and buries her alive. So yeah, Michael Madsen here, looking like the love child of Bret Michaels and Mickey Rourke with the hat and the hair, just the fashion of this man. But to his defense, Tarantino never really abandoned Michael Madsen. Abandon's a really intense word because it seems as though Madsen had plenty of opportunities with other directors and in Hollywood at large that he kind of, you know, he fumbled the ball, as one would say. But Tarantino, you know, a lot of times would find ways to, even up until like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, he would have work for his buddy Michael. And one thing I can say positively about Michael Madsen in this is he knows it and he's going for it. As for the character itself, though, yeah, it's kind of weird that it's this literally described as Deadly Viper Assassin and he's just getting emasculated by strippers and this guy who owns a strip club. We do get a tremendous cameo by Sid Haig, who the boss is like, is that Bud? Tell him to get his fucking ass in here. And he goes, Bud, he'd like a word with you. It's a really good little moment in the movie. But yeah, I agree with Chaz and the idea of trying to sell him as this badass. I mentioned Mickey Rourke as a joke earlier, but I guess that would kind of be analogous in the sense of, you look at like Randy the Ram, this guy is supposed to be this badass that, you know, is getting talked down to by this short little wiener at his job. But the difference here being is that Michael Madsen is literally an assassin for hire that has killed God only knows how many people. And he's just unclogging toilets and shit until he shoots Uma Thurman in the chest with some rock salt. And then,
can we not gloss over that moment for a second? Because Alex, you earlier in this recording said that this film was quite misogynist. And after we, you know, were listening to quotes about Volume 1 about Quentin Tarantino single-handedly saved feminism in the action genre, we get to this movie and we've seen her fucking walk head on into Oren Ishii's den and call out the ADA and kill every single one of them single-handedly. And here she's so fucking dumb that I don't know why she's wearing a mask, but she's wearing a mask, you know, clearly to camouflage herself in amongst her leather jacket and denim jeans or whatever else she was in. And then goes to all the lengths of like hiding under the caravan only to open the front door. And he's just sitting there waiting with a shotgun. I'm like, what is happening? How is this the same character? Why doesn't she fucking stand outside and say, Bud, get your fat ass out here. I'm going to kill you.
Especially because, as we pointed out in the last episode, she ended that confrontation with Lucy Liu by sending a message and letting them know that she's coming. Like, she doesn't have the element of surprise. So she should expect Bud to be expecting her.
She should be, like, in the first one, it's fine being what she's being with, like, you know, her samurai sword fighting kung fu shit. She should be Gina Carano and Haywire in the second one as far as, like, you know, game of camouflage and espionage. And she should be clandestine, not literally kicking down the front door. Like, hey, is anyone in here? Bang. Done.
Ain't nobody a badass with a double dose of rock salt that deep in their tits.
So what does it say that the one Viper that was probably the one that's absolutely a loser is the one that gets the drop on her? He could have killed her. I mean, he could have ended the movie at this point if he had used real bullets.
He's not the only one that gets the drop on her, because Bill does too.
And right. We're just so
gonna, this is going to be my recurring theme for Contrarian's Corner, is just how fucking stupid the bride is in this volume in comparison to the first one. Like, this is what I was alluding to, Alex, when you said it felt misogynist. Like, the bride just feels like shit happens to her in this movie. And other than, I'll say, the fight with Elle, which is pretty fucking spectacular. I'm going to give that one moment of this film that I'm like, yes.
There's even still, though, there's some parts in that are like, why? There's repeated cuts to each feet? Woman getting hit in the vagina that's like, okay, well, what is the... Did I miss the memo? Because dudes getting hit in the nuts is always funny. I didn't know if like that was like a new thing that I didn't know, that women getting hit in the crotch is funny. But, you know, piggybacking on that here, the sequence where Bud and his local yokel friend are going to bury her alive, there's some like Rob Zombie level, like demeaning dialogue of women during this. That it's just kind of like, Tarantino gets a lot of shit for, you know, his portrayal of certain characters in different movies. But honestly, like, this is real talk. I was kind of surprised with some of the dialogue in this that was pretty violent against women, even for, you know, Tarantino, who, to me, in his defense, I think he's violent towards everybody. That's just kind of that's what he does. But there was a little bit of a surprise here with some of the verbiage that was used. But then they do bury her alive. It's not quite The Vanishing, and it's not quite Buried starring Ryan Reynolds either. So, but she's there. And then we get an extended, very extended. It's like one of those grabbers that, you know, people that need to reach across the room to get something would use. That's basically what this part of the movie is, because we spend 20-30 minutes with Pai Mei. And this is like what I was talking about previously, and in both Contrarian's Corner and Real Talk of our Volume 1 episode, was this shit, Transparent again. This is just Tarantino wanting to make a kung fu movie that he watched when he was younger, And that's fine. You can do that, but you can't expect the masses of audiences to like have the same boner for that shit that you do, man. And this was brutal. I had a really hard time getting through this sequence of the movie.
Alex, would it have been easier if, as I mentioned in the previous episode, Tarantino had gone with his original plan of he himself playing Paime?
Well, it would give us something to talk about for sure.
It sounds horrible. And the fact that the only reason he didn't do it is because he realized it was too much work. Not because he thought it would be a terrible idea, but just because it was the, you know, shooting
him
in
those
one.
Same with those same eyebrows and mustache and the beard and the hair yep. and everything. God, he is psychotic, though. I could see I think we talked about, you know, Chaz. He has more grounds to be like, what the fuck, than we do. But Tarantino playing the Australian bounty hunter and Django for no real reason, just so he could.
Just this morning I was listening, like the episode dropped for volume one, and I was listening to it and I heard myself trying to do a Quentin Tarantino impersonation. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I sound like Quentin doing his Australian accent in Django.
So, Julio, that was all to say that would definitely check out as something he wanted to do.
I agree, but also I think that it's a big red flag or you know, some sort of like that element, that idea, even if it didn't come to fruition, I think it tells you exactly where his head was at when he was making this movie.
That's fair.
I don't care. Yeah, let's just do it. It's bananas, though, that the character of Paime exists in the same movie where the character of Bud exists.
Yes.
You know, it's like that doesn't work. And it's literally like, you're right. There's like one scene from, we're not even done with the Bud chapter before we jump into the Paime, you know, montage, training, whatever. Alex, what I called this on my notes was the Kung Fu Whiplash, because it's basically the bride being brutalized into excellence. And I did wonder, I was like, I know that Alex likes the tough love kind of teaching. So were you?
It's Tarantino's Rocky IV training sequence here, pretty much. It's on fire. No, the importance of this, though, is it's the gun in the first act. They introduce the notion of the, I wrote down the touch of death because I just think of The Simpsons. That's like one of the early seasons where Bart says he's going to karate and he knows the touch of death, but this is the 5-point palm exploding heart technique. This is Paime's. And yeah, when you mention that in, you know, the first hour of the movie, everyone's going to expect now that the climax is going to be this thing that's going to make this person's heart explode. So you know what to expect. But yeah, Paime bullies her, even won't let her eat unless she does it the way he wants her to. Which, to be fair, I feel like everyone should know how to use chopsticks, so I'm on his side there.
Not with broken knuckles, but sure.
Well, he trained her to be tough, you know? She wouldn't have escaped from this casket if she didn't have those chopstick skills.
It's the Whiplash episode all over again.
Yeah, it leads to essentially a tutorial of how to escape from being buried alive. You need a flashlight, like a straight razor, and then to have spent like 2 years training the martial arts with Paime.
You also need the sadistic psycho that buried you alive to begin with to have decided that it was in his best interest not to blind you with the mace. I don't understand, like, the character of Bud. I guess he might be the most complex in the sense that he's the most contradictory in the way that he's depicted. You know, he is a complete bum that gets no respect at his bouncer job, but he's also smart enough, smarter than all the other Vipers, to really capture the bride, but not smart enough to kill her right away.
Well, because part of the deal was she has to suffer, but at the same time, it's like,
you could have just told Elle that she suffered.
Yeah.
Who's she going to know?
Yeah.
That's like horror movie 101 shit of just, well, my job's done here, and you don't actually see the person die. Like, of course she's going to come back.
I mean, and then we get the ignominy of Bud, like the bride doesn't take out Bud. Again, this movie just like takes nearly all agency away from the bride. She gets two moments in the entire movie where she is actually responsible for her own success, which is like the fight with Elle and then the end of the movie.
I hadn't even thought of it that you guys called it out. Like literally the last like action sequence of her in the first one is that scene where she kills the the 88s and, you know, is like this unstoppable force. And here, yeah, she's one step away from slipping on a banana peel and falling onto her own knife or some shit.
Yeah.
Hates Caucasians, despises Americans, and has nothing but contempt for women.
In a flashback to years earlier, Bill tells a young bride of the legendary martial arts master Pei Mei and his 5-point palm exploding heart technique, a death blow that Pei refuses to teach his students. Properly used, the attack is reputed to leave an opponent able to only take 5 steps before dying. Bill takes the bride to Pai's temple for training. Pei ridicules and torments her during training, but she eventually gains his respect. In the present, the bride uses Pai's techniques to escape the coffin and claw her way to the surface. L arrives at Bud's trailer and kills him with a black mamba hidden within the case full of money for the sword. She calls Bill and tells him that the bride has killed Bud and that she has killed the bride using the bride's real name, Beatrix Kiddo. As L exits the trailer, Beatrix ambushes her and they fight. L, who has taught by Pei, taunts Beatrix by revealing she had killed Pei by poisoning his favorite meal in retribution for him plucking out one of her eyes after she called him a miserable old fool. Enraged, Beatrix plucks out L's remaining eye and leaves her screaming in the trailer with the black mamba. Fish heads. Either of y'all ever had fish heads?
Like, are they, is that just something that you call something that is not a fish head, or is it literal with fish heads?
I think it's a literal fish head. I know that's a delicacy in some cultures. I've never had it.
I mean, not to take away from Julio's Peruvian origins, but my wife's family is from the selva, like the jungle side of Peru, and there is no part of the fish left at the end of a meal.
Fair enough. But they're supposed to be tasty. The delectable parts, fish heads contain what are called cheeks, the fishy equivalent of a chicken's oyster, it says in quotations here. Tender, tasty, and often overlooked. Just behind the head are what are known as fish collars, a firm, richly flavored cut that doesn't make it into the typical fillet. So learn something new every day. I think, honestly, if it was just looking back at me on my plate, that would be the hardest part to overcome. I don't doubt that someone can make that shit taste like $1 million, but those, you know, it looking at you, having a face, that would be the hard part to overcome.
Well, the other problem with fish heads, Alex, is that it's very easy for someone to poison you if you're eating fish heads, apparently.
One guy who could not, the issue wasn't the texture or the face looking at him, it was the poison in it, was Pei Mei, who succumbed.
So is this Pei Mei being nerfed? He's the ultimate badass when he's trading the bride, and then he just falls for the oldest trick, letting his bitter disciple serve him food.
I mean, everyone is an idiot in this movie, you know. Like Bud not expecting L to try and kill him, the bride walking into Bud's shotgun, Pei Mei letting himself get poisoned by L.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, maybe the whole point of the story is that everybody's dumb, but that's not as interesting. There are a couple of like really good ideas in this sequence that I think Tarantino completely weakens by either not trusting the audience or just not being able to help himself and tell us how clever he is. One is that Bud didn't pawn the sword. And, you know, that reveal is amazing. Unfortunately, it's followed by L and the bride talking about it. I was like, you don't need to tell me about this. Like, I saw the sword. I saw the dedication. It's like, that's it. It's like, he didn't sell it. He has an attachment either to the sword or the fact that it was a gift from his brother, you know, or maybe he thinks that someday he will be the badass that he used to be. And that's why he still keeps the sword. I mean, that moment says so much. And then it has to be undercut by L and the bride are like, oh, well, he said he pawned it. Well, I guess he lied. Blah, 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 blah. Stop it. And then when the bride and Bill are having the little camping trip, Bill says, you gotta be careful around this guy. Don't get sassy. If you give him a look, he's gonna pluck your eye out. That's all he needs to say for all of us to instantly go like, oh, so he took L's eye out. He didn't need to say it again. That's, you know, that's smart storytelling. But then he can't help himself. Then the bride has to ask L, hey, what'd you do when he plucked your eye out?
Did anyone else during the L and bride fight go, where the fuck is the black mamba? As they're falling over on the couch, through the walls, like rolling on the floor, going, where did the snake go?
I mean, we do see it at the end. I guess he was just respectfully giving them their space.
I mean, in Quentin's mild defense, it felt like that snake used up most of its venom on Bud and might not have had another bite and wanted to hide. But then I think Tarantino should have shown us, as they're rolling on top of the couch with the deadly snake underneath it, what the fuck the snake is doing.
They even step over Bud's dead body a couple of times. We will see Bud, but we won't see the snake.
There are some dope practical effects of the swelling of the black mamba on his face. Mm-hmm. They get into the big fight, go flying through walls and shit. At one point, Uma Thurman's working a pretty good rear naked choke. She's not doing it classic way. She's doing like a Gable grip or a Severn style choke, which I know that wasn't intentional, but I appreciated. I did take note because I rewatched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood not too long ago. The ice tray that Bud uses when making his margaritas, takes the ice tray out of the freezer. That's the same one DiCaprio has in his house in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that old 60s style ice tray where it's not like the plastic ones that you, the three of us, would be used to, where you kind of crack it and the cubes come out. It's got that metal piece in it that you use to break into, you know, the individual cubes. So again, something that Tarantino, if you've watched all his movies and you do so regularly, you can always see like little tiny things like that that he clearly just thinks are cool and he puts into multiple movies of his. Those margaritas that Madsen made looked real shitty. So we learn her name, Beatrix Kiddo.
Which is a big fucking reveal because Bill calls her Kiddo. Oh my God. Yeah. That's why we had to blank out Beatrix in the first movie.
So would you guys say that Tarantino overestimated how much we would care about her real name?
Like, what was the idea? Like, what could have been the reveal of, like, she was Joan of Arc or, like, you know, this is Yoko Ono? Like, what did he expect, like, the big reveal to be in terms of, like, oh. But no, it's just Beatrix Kiddo. But she has vanquished the last of her foes. There's just one remaining. The boss fight is at hand. You know, her liquid snake now needs to be taken out.
I will say the one Kill Bill spinoff I'm really interested in is Elle post-blinding. Like, what does Elle do with her life with no eyeballs?
So you don't think the Black Mamba kills her? Because I thought that the implication is we see the Black Mamba again, kind of like as a... to letting us know, don't worry, the snake's going to take care of her.
Well, she's going to be screwed either way because she's literally has no eyes and she's out in the middle of nowhere in El Paso, I think is where they said they were. You know, she can't really drive anywhere. And the only person that could help her, she just killed. So
she has a shit ton of money because the bride didn't take it.
Llewellyn Moss is going to... That happens 15 minutes after the bride leaves is Josh Brolin stumbles into this scene and he finds all the cash there and takes it back home.
We're about to head into my favorite scene in the movie. And by that, I mean my least favorite scene in the movie.
Oh, no. I actually quite like this scene, but go on.
Michael Parks? Are we talking about Michael Parks?
Yeah. Just doing his awful Brazilian accent.
Like, oh, God. It's not the accent, it's the speed. It's just this scene, if you played it normally, I think it would be like maybe 2 minutes. Somehow it's like 5 to 7 minutes long, and it feels like 20 minutes long.
But also, I mean, as with the first movie where they cut her, you know, finding her money from the, you know, I don't think anyone would just care if she next scene would show up at Bill's house. She's making her way through the list, right? We don't need to find out her suddenly being a detective and Bill's in some kind of hidden spot.
Where's Bill? Bill is at the vehicle on the road to Salina. I will draw you a map.
As far as the scene itself goes, it's one of those classic Tarantino scenes where nothing in it is explained and there's so much like character and color to the surroundings, like the waitress who her lips are all fucked up and, you know, just the literal cabana or whatever they're in. Tarantino's very good at those scenes where you end up with more questions than, you know, answers. And then he does the thing of telling you, his audience members, like, you don't need to care because it doesn't really matter because we're going here now. So, yeah, it's in Mexico. Beatrix meets a retired pimp, Esteban Viejo, who helps her find Bill. She tracks him to his home and discovers that their daughter, Bibi, is still alive and is now 4 years old. Now, Bill has a fucking dope-ass apartment here, man. Good. That old CRT TV he's got there with the katana above it. I was like, that's awesome. The circular couch. It's got the bar. It's got the view of the ocean. All right. She's never seen this kid before, yet instantly knows who it is. Chaz, you have kids. Do you think if you didn't see your kids like from their birth to 4 years later, you would have recognized them?
I think I wouldn't have recognized them, but I would have made the pretty instant leap of... I'm tracking down this. Am I allowed? Just so the American listeners are aware, in Australia, the word cunt is thrown around a lot more liberally and almost as a term of affection on occasion. But if I was tracking down my arch cunt nemesis and happened to find that he had a child exactly the right age, I would probably put two and two together without needing to like compare hair samples.
But you're Australian though. You're not a fucking American. So your first instinct also wouldn't be to point a gun at the child. So that's a compliment to you and your countrymen.
I agree with you, Chaz, that I think that if you pause for a moment and you think about it, you're like, well, I guess she could figure it, like she can sense it, right? Like it, the pieces add together. The problem is that I have to pause to think about it because I had the same thought. Like I was like, wait a second, how does she know? It could be anybody's kid. And then I paused and I was like, well, logic dictates that, you know, who there's two options. One, it's her kid, or two, Bill is such a psycho that he has a random four-year-old that he knows she's going to assume is her kid. I mean, I guess it's a 50-50, but that's still, you know, I don't know. I guess you go into the unexplainable of a mother's instinct. And, well, she recognizes it because it's her child. And honestly, from where the movie goes from here, where there's like truth serum and like exploding hearts, it's not that much of a leap to assume that the mom can just kind of like feel the motherhood between her and her daughter that she's never seen. But this is like the big scene. And I paused the movie just to see how much longer I had. And my mind was blown because it says the last chapter. So I was like, oh, it must be like the last 30 minutes. There was like an hour left of movie. Alex, I know that you do this a lot where you just pause and then suddenly like your heart sinks when you see how much time. Yep. Did you have this experience, or were you knowingly avoiding the pause button because you didn't want to suffer through this?
And I paused it to take an actual break after she got to the apartment. I was like, there's still 45 minutes left in this movie. And the most egregious part of the movie is here, where after they have the reunion, there is this scene in which David Carradine is making ham and cheese sandwiches for Beatrix and Bibi and has this long monologue about the difference between life and death. And he's comparing it to the situation in which Bibi took her goldfish out of the bowl and then stepped on it when it was on the ground and it died. And, you know, explaining that she was honest. What it is that this is the scene, like Tarantino thought he was doing the watch scene from Pulp Fiction again. And it is nowhere near the watch scene from Pulp Fiction. And it just goes on for fucking ever. And, you know, there is some charm and kind of like, ha, to David Carradine making a sandwich and then cutting the crust off before he gives it to the little girl. Like, there's some charm about it, but the dialogue and like the point they're trying to make has already been made numerous times in not only this movie, but the previous 2 hours we spent with these characters. So this part to me was like the most Tarantino, you know, the mask Dennis Hopper uses in Blue Velvet. That's just Tarantino with his own farts here, writing this and directing this.
I think the worst part is that, you know, he's talking about the dead goldfish as he's making the sandwiches. And then we cut to him taking the little girl to the bed. Like they've been eating, they already ate. She's putting her to bed. He's still talking about the goldfish. The story hasn't ended. Look, this was the end point, right? Like she wanted to kill Bill. It's on the title. And so you think that when she finally gets to see Bill, all right, so she has to buy her time because there's a kid. But once the kid's put to bed and it's just the two adults, man, let's get to it, you know? But instead, it's just more talking and more talking. Like, the actual fight is, I don't know, 30 seconds? There's like 30 minutes of talking, 30 seconds of fight.
Oh, it's very anticlimactic. And then the whole thing with the truth serum is like, what does he ask her during that that's so imperative that he already doesn't at least have some knowledge of?
And I mean, I just, the whole truth serum thing was like, first of all, this is the woman that from the first movie, I'm like, she could have been able to snatch that out of the air and throw it back and hit him between the eyes. They could have had the whole same conversation without the truth serum. And I think it would have been better because she would have been in a position of at least relative threat and menace and power.
There is also something a little demythifying when it comes to Bill, when he's just acting like some random dude that just can't wrap his head around the fact that his ex-girlfriend broke up with him. Like, that's literally what this scene is. And I was like, I just wanted you guys to fight. I don't need this. This is just really... like, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out why she left you, you know? Like, it, and they paint him as this guy that's a mastermind and he's pretty street smart, but does he have that much of a blind spot? And him having that blind spot, does it make him a better character? I don't think so. I think it makes him, you know, this scene drags because he's asking questions that we know the answers to. So there's no real... And the idea that he developed a truth serum... what is it? What is this movie?
Jumps the shark here for sure.
I mean, before we get into the Superman speech and how everyone feels about it, I did actually quite like yet another flashback to when the bride finds out she's pregnant and has that exchange with the other assassin sent to kill her. That was actually quite a tense... You know, like, we've already talked about how much of a cliche it is for Tarantino to interrupt action scenes with dialogue, but I was like, this one I'm on board for.
It has a good payoff, just the fact that at the end, the other assassin goes, congratulations. I like the idea. I just don't like that it extends that climax even more. I wish that you had placed it somewhere else in the movie and not... at a time where I'm already, you know, I just wanted to wrap up, and instead it goes into another flashback. So my feeling is, oh no, it's going to go even longer.
So Julio, how do you feel about Quentin Tarantino explaining superheroes to you?
Bill-splaining Superman? man, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's some normies out there that they've never had conversations about Superman and superheroes and the idea of like the secret identity versus the real identity and all this stuff. But this is like, like, at first I wrote on my notes, Superman 101. I go, oh, no shit. You know, Clark Kent is like the persona. He's always Superman. But even, man, this was 2004, right?
Yeah.
So he wrote it 2003, 2002. I think that even by then, Superman comics had moved past the idea that Clark Kent is just this bumbling buffoon. The way that he describes Clark Kent, that's not how Clark Kent has been portrayed in a long time, you know, since the Christopher Reeve movies, I think. And so his thesis is that, oh, Clark Kent is the way he views humanity, and Clark Kent is an idiot, therefore he sees humanity as idiots, as beneath him. But that's an outdated portrayal of Superman. Has Bill not read any comics in the last 30 years?
Well, no, because he's not even a boomer. He's like a silent generation.
He's from the George Reeves Superman.
Yeah, but we criticized Quentin for opening with a fucking Klingon proverb in the first movie. And, you know, we talked about his celebration of dorkdom. And I think there would have been a lot of people going to this movie who didn't have that knowledge. Like, this is, you know, not pre-Marvel, but before the MCU is what it is. I just wish that it was slightly more insightful. Like, it actually kind of says, oh, I like comic books, but I don't actually know them that well. Like, almost every other comic book character has had some version of, my mask is my real face. You know, like, you know, Batman's mask is Bruce Wayne in the same way that Clark Kent is Superman's mask. You know, Civil War in the comics was actually started by all the superheroes removing their masks and revealing their identity. Sorry, I'm just showing my own dorkdom here. Fucking Wonder Woman is an ambassador to Themyscira. Everyone fucking knows who Wonder Woman is, right? Like, it just, to me, it's like, QT trying to show off and not doing a very good job of it.
As you know, I'm quite keen on comic books.
After Beatrix puts BB to bed, Bill shoots Beatrix with a dart containing a truth serum and interrogates her. She explains that she left the deadly vipers when she discovered she was pregnant in order to give BB a better life. Bill explains that he assumed she was dead. He ordered her assassination when he discovered she was alive and engaged to a, quote, jerk he assumed was the father of her child. The two begin to fight, but Beatrix traps Bill's sword in her scabbard and strikes him with the 5-point palm exploding heart technique. Surprised that Pi taught her the attack, Bill reconciles with her, then falls dead as he walks away. Beatrix leaves with BB to start a new life. The fight here is basically they're both in chairs the whole time. And
like deck chairs or lawn chairs, right? Like patio furniture.
Yeah. He mistimes, or she just properly has the right distance on a stab attempt he has with the sword and sheaths it, and bing, bang, boom, his heart has exploded.
Well, conveniently, he has time to have some parting lines.
Well, that's the importance of them explaining that he has to take 5 steps before it works.
Right. So technically, he could have lived forever, or at least, you know, like a normal span of his life, as long as he never walked again. Like, if he stayed sitting down the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Man, what a dumbass.
And I've done this, like, every time I've watched this movie, I've counted the steps, and I swear he takes 6.
Well, the last one, his heart has already exploded. It's just his body going on automatic. It's just okay. That last step, he's already dead. It's just, man, we're not Drive Zero, so Tarantino's never going to listen to this. I wish he did, though, because I have like a last-minute rewrite that I think would make the movie slightly better. And I guess, honestly, for all we've said in Contrarian's Corner and Real Talk, you know, over the last episode and this one, I do think he's a really good writer, which is what makes, you know, when he misses, it's just so frustrating. And I think he misses here at the end when he goes, like, I like the surprise, right? Even though we knew that Bill is caught off guard. It's like, holy shit, he taught you the thing that he wasn't going to teach anybody, right? And then he says, why didn't you tell me? Man, how is it that she does not reply, because I didn't want to hurt you? Like, that to me, that would encapsulate her struggle. You know, she's been trying to kill Bill. When she got to Bill, she had such trouble killing him because she still has some affection for this guy. But instead, she's like, because I guess I'm a bad girl. And I was like, oh, come on, man. It's a big letdown. But Alex, you're the romantic here. So did you shed a tear when these two star-crossed lovers exchange words for the last time?
Nah, man. I was pretty much done. We go into detail about why this doesn't work for me and Volume 1, we'll talk a little bit more about it here when we get to Real Talk for this, but I was just kind of like, thought they both deserved to die. So I was
wow, what's gonna happen to that child though?
Well, that's, you know, a good manipulation of the emotions, bringing that kid, and she's adorable too. That brings like a ray of I guess you'd say sunshine to this kind of bleak story. Yeah, I guess that's true. Uma Thurman didn't deserve to die because she has that kid to take care of. But for me, I just wanted the movie to end. So more dialogue meant I was going to be there longer.
After the truth serum malarkey, how does everyone feel about, once again, the movie jagging into suddenly taking itself seriously again with Uma crying on the floor? And, you know, we talked about her Oscar clip from the first movie when she wakes up and it's like, once again, like, what movie are we in again? I'm sorry. Like,
yeah, it just needed to fade to black after Bill collapses. That's it. It was Kill Bill and she killed Bill. That's it. It was not Save the Kid. So at least we got the Avengers Endgame / Twilight end credits.
Oh, yeah. It was the dramatic conclusion credits.
Yeah. Everybody, the nameless, faceless, the 88s got name checked there. But that's it. It's over.
Mercifully.
Are you guys ready to go to Real Talk?
Yes.
Let us kill Bill.